Episode 9 of Season 17, this is Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell in my kitchen with Mr. Miles Elam, who's a programmer and a pedantic...
Curmudgeon.
Curmudgeon, that's what it is. Hi, Miles.
Hi.
And also Mr. Brian Young, a software developer and maker and father and artiste. Hi.
Hi there. We're in Lyle's kitchen cooking up some tech.
Oh, wow. Hey, let's talk about net neutrality. Miles, what does it hurt? How can it hurt us?
Well, according to Republican Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, net neutrality hurts healthcare and helps porn.
What?
Whoa, okay.
I was waiting for that response.
I think you got some splaining to do.
This is an area where I don't know how to be... cordial with this, just because net neutrality, the position behind that is that each service that goes out is going to be treated equally, and you don't get preferential treatment by any way, right? Especially by incumbents. Like, for example, Netflix is very large right now. They have some deep pockets rather than someone who just has a startup just trying to get things going. And so if Netflix gets a deal with Comcast and says, hey, if we pay you this much money, we get preferential treatment and, you know, maybe you don't go toward the cap and all these other items. And then the person who's just trying to get into the market doesn't have that same leverage. They get left out. That's the idea behind net neutrality and what we've talked about in the past.
Where we would prefer a net neutrality situation where you nobody can produce an incumbency that has better strengths over
right.
other people's.
Users are paying for their internet connection, you know, paying their provider AT&T or Verizon or Comcast or the like, and providers like, you know, Netflix or the startup are paying their provider to be connected up to the internet, and so there shouldn't be any preferential treatment there as to how you go unless, you know, that's pretty much you pay to play. You've
okay.
already done it. As opposed to if someone is paying an incumbent for preferential access, that means that...
Okay, I know you can't represent this opinion of this Republican senator, but sure. What is the claim that it hurts healthcare?
So this is where I think that the actual item is not very popular, and so it's trying to be spun. Because in the past, when net neutrality has come up in the FCC, it had an unprecedented follow-up by citizens saying, this is what we want, this is what we want.
Yes.
Which is actually amazing, because it's a relatively complex thing to wrap your head around as far as many consumers may see advantages in mm-hmm. breaking net neutrality.
Right. So how the spin works is saying, if you can't determine the traffic that goes through, then all sorts of bad effects would happen. Like, for example, porn and illegal activities is the phrasing that he used, trying to lump things together there.
Porn and also illegal activities.
Yeah. would take up a good deal of the bandwidth, and then when you want a service that you need, like, for example, healthcare systems talking to one another, they would get choked out, and maybe you would run the risk of causing a problem.
First off, that's patently ridiculous.
Yes, exactly.
Because your healthcare service, the reason why the websites for hospitals and things of that nature are perform poorly is not because network connectivity, it's because of implementation details. And the porn industry is extremely good at implementation details. Additionally, they're pushing a lot more bandwidth. You know, normally pornography has a lot of video involved in it.
Right.
And so the bandwidth usage of that versus your healthcare system, totally different usages.
Right. If it weren't for the porn industry, our internet connections would not be as fast as they are today.
Why do you say that?
Because, one, there was a fair amount of money going to them
yeah.
In the 90s and the early aughts. Things have tapered off since then, glut in the market and all that. But early on, at the same time, you had industry shows like Comdex in Las Vegas. Right across the street, you had porn conventions. And it wasn't a coincidence, because the attendees at the porn conventions would walk across the street to Comdex and look at their network technologies, because porn was where you had a lot of
money and a lot of need for new infrastructure.
Well, they had a lot of the videos and pictures. They had a lot of the media content that just wasn't available. This is long before
long before YouTube and Netflix were doing a lot of streaming video.
We're talking real right. player, right?
Yeah.
Or actually, a lot of them had custom implementations.
Yeah, JPEG streaming custom implementations, as I recall. Yeah. A lot of that.
Or things like that. Things that are based upon a Flash plugin, or things that are... another common thing that was happening was you had a player that you had to download the plugin to be able to...
Mm-hmm.
Not that I know this.
including viruses.
Right. And
well, so yeah. So this perspective is, if you don't allow industry to produce opposite of net neutrality, you'll have a situation where two different needs are fighting into the same bandwidth.
Right.
Which at some level is true, but if you make it a neutral net, if you will, then there's not the maximum bandwidth would have, I mean, the video bandwidth would have as much priority as the network that was doing healthcare. Mm-hmm. So theoretically, you'd get bits from both of them the same speed. Right. And that actually is a better situation.
That, and if you were actually concerned about whether healthcare providers could get their communications out, then you would carve in an exception to say net neutrality, except for emergency services and things that have to right. do with public safety.
Absolutely.
And they get higher priority.
And that would actually make sense in some ways,
yeah,
right?
That's how you would affect that. You wouldn't try to demonize one thing and then say, like, this is why we're going to get rid of it. That's why we call it spin.
And the metaphor for public roads is a perfect example of that, right? Everybody that pays taxes on their vehicle therefore has access to public roads. And if you hear a siren coming, you get out of the way. Because you're a second-class citizen on this system, because our safety needs trump your business, whatever you're doing.
Your individual desire to get to work 5 minutes earlier.
Right. Yeah. So, and that's how we do it. We manage laws in that format. So, yeah, it's a ridiculous argument.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because he also used an analogy of a bridge and talked about, well, if you have a bridge and then it's going over someone else's property and causing a problem, and really the analogy is, if you have a bridge, we don't want the person who controls the bridge to be able to say, okay, you're free, but you need to pay me some extra money. But a right. bridge was paid with taxes. No, you're going to pay us a little bit more.
Right.
And really, that is true. The internet infrastructure that we have today was heavily subsidized by public taxes and...
including last mile stuff from telcos yeah. to into the home.
Yeah, assuming right. that the individual person didn't buy that last mile stuff, which happens in a lot of rural areas.
Well, yeah. And I don't know. I've tried to figure out how to explain net neutrality to people for ages. But to anybody that's on the conservative bent, it just seems to be best explained through markets. And you're going to do better if you've got competing markets for connection and then competing markets for services. And if you keep those separate, they will independently work themselves out better than if you start tying things together and letting entrenched corporate interests literally take over a market, which would include your connection.
Yeah, that's great.
How I usually speak to conservative friends about that is, in general, they are very bullish on capitalism, but they are absolutely not on crony capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That idea of, slapping backs and having a old man
which is
club.
What the lack of net neutrality produces.
Right. And so net neutrality is a way to keep things an actual competition as opposed to just, nepotism.
And if there's any one thing that we can do to improve prices of internet connections and services, it would be to somehow provide a framework for more competition to home internet.
All right. I think we did a pretty good job tackling that. With Brian, thanks, Miles, for that.
Mm-hmm.
Brian, I think that what you're about to try to tackle is extremely difficult to do via radio. So good luck.
I've never tried that before, have I?
Let's do it.
Okay. So we've got other podcasts we listen to. We mentioned Security Now every once in a while with Steve Gibson, and he brought this up. And, honestly, I've heard about the Conway's Game of Life for years. I've seen it, many demonstrations of this rule set, this game that we're about to describe. And
an exercise that's part of a lot of intro to programming.
Yeah. Well, and
it's
true.
And it's not that complex to be able to understand and implement.
Well, no, and we're going to go through the rules real quick, too. It's a visual thing, but when I heard it described on the radio, it did not actually click into me how impressive this is. But what I'm going to talk about actually gave me a real insight into how some really small set of rules can make something really complex.
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked a lot about AI in the past, and you two have talked a lot about how a programming, a spec would become the programming language itself, so the mm-hmm. programmers aren't necessarily writing the whole program. Remember that debate a few months ago?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Conway's Game of Life. If you imagine a checkerboard, any sort of grid of squares, you can set up this rule set of four different rules that allow you to draw out shapes on the screen. And then every turn, if this was a real game, if we were talking about board game, you can call it a turn, or you can call it a generation. Every time that the board gets advanced to the next round, these rules control whether a square is light or dark. So that's the basic concept. These simple rules will change whether a square that is now dark will become light, or a square that's now light will become dark.
This is a life simulation, a cell simulation, yeah, simple simulation.
You hear automaton, cellular automaton used in
automata. Automata.
Thank you. Yeah. I have made that mistake before. Anyways, so these rules are based on whether any neighboring squares are dark or light, alive or dead. So
so traditionally what you do is you have a black field and you add a cell, which is white, and that means it's alive this round. And right. then what it will happen next round is based off of what cells are next to each other.
Yeah, all the eight different neighbors that go around the square.
Okay.
So if one square has two neighbors that are dark or three neighbors that are dark, that square will remain dark the next round. That's all.
Wait, it's dark...
Alive. We'll call it alive and dead.
I always thought the white was alive, but you could do it inverse.
That's easy to inverse, yeah.
Okay.
So just like in a game of Othello, these rules will flip a square from one color to another. So the alive squares, if there's two neighbors that are alive, it will be alive next round. If there's three squares or neighbors that are alive, it'll be alive next round.
And if there's four?
If it's four, it'll die.
Okay.
If there's,
so it's overcrowded.
It's overcrowded, and so it'll die. If there's one, it's too lonely, and it will die.
Gotcha.
So that's that was one basic rule.
So if you were to start with a blank field and put one cell on there, the next round there'd be no life. But if you put a kind of did a little squiggle of like 14 different cells, kind of in a kind of random pattern around each other, some of them would go out, some of them would come on, some other cells would come on. Based on these rule sets.
Right. And the
so
important,
it kind of looks like organisms living.
And the way I've seen this before is little demos of it is it just they allow you to set up the state, set up the initial conditions, go ahead and click which squares will be on and off. And I would see grids that are maybe, I don't know, 50 squares by 50 squares mm-hmm. or 100 squares by 100 squares. And I'd play with this and it'd be kind of cool because you'd set up a few shapes and you start it running and it would shoot off something over in one direction that would go across the screen. Some repeating shape that each round would animate across.
That's called square. A glider.
A glider.
A glider is a self-propelling but stable in but moving form structure. And then basically what works is that as every generation, it kind of shifts one direction and it keeps on shifting and it's relatively stable. It'll go forever. And you can have gliders going in different directions based on the structure you create. Yeah.
Right. And I hadn't seen this but until this was described to me, but you can make what they call a blinker. So if you've got three squares right next to each other and nothing else around it. The square in the middle, it has two neighbors. It will survive. The squares on either side, they don't have neighbors. They're not going to survive. But because the empty squares, the dead squares above and below have three neighbors each, they will generate a new square. So you end up having a line that goes vertical, horizontal,
and it's
continues
stable.
That. It's a stable pattern.
Right.
Okay, so what we're talking about this for is because it's been passed around the internet that somebody has used these very basic rules on a very large grid. And that was the key piece that I didn't understand before. On a very large grid, they use these simple rules to make a fully functional digital clock. We're talking about a clock that shows time in numerals, not any sort of
like an
binary
LCD.
Format. Yeah, an LCD.
Liquid segment display.
LCD? No, LCD.
Liquid crystal display.
Long before LCD.
An eight-segment LCD.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry. and so this person was able to use these really basic rules to create this clock. And it is absolutely amazing. Yeah, because
to be clear, like what the programming is just drawing something. Like when
setting
you,
up the
when
initial
you draw
state.
All of these different pixels, all these different cells, and then you let it go, becomes a clock and continues to be a clock.
Yeah. So at the very top, you've got something that emits one of these gliders or other shapes that are able to be produced and directs it at three other shapes, which are, you can imagine them as internal gears. And depending on where those other shapes receive one of these gliders, they emit another glider that goes down towards the very large shapes that create the numbers. And there's little deflectors there that will deflect the gliding shapes into the right places so that it'll trigger the next change of shape for this LCD.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And I mean, this is definitely the most complicated programmed structure of these. Our friend Warren Sack, professor at UCSC, he has, in his book that he's working on right now with MIT Press, he talks a bit about cellular automata mm-hmm. and how it's Turing complete. In fact, there's actually a single line automata form that is also Turing complete. Now, it's a lot harder to program in that because you don't have two dimensions that you can actually move things around in, but you can actually do it in one line segment as well, which is insane.
So wait, describe what Turing complete actually means. This has been bantered around a lot.
Okay. Alan Turing came up with a set of rules that you'd need to do logic in a machine. And that complete set is what's required to do what we think of as a computer. So when you define what a computing programming language is, you say it's Turing complete if it can do all the functions of a computer. And every computer could run any other software because the Turing completeness means it can do all the things a computer can do. And that has to do with being able to store a value, being able to compare a value, being able to add and subtract. And I can't remember, there's like 12 of them, 12 rules you have to be able to do. I don't know how many rules are in Turing complete. Do you know, Miles?
I used to know. Yeah. I'm distracted right now by the fact that I was completely wrong and cellular automaton is correct. Cellular automata is the plural version, which means multiple boards.
Oh,
but you, a single you, one. You are the best type of pedant ever.
Did no, I correct myself?
Yourself. It's perfect. So the thing that's neat about this project is you can actually run it. And we have a link on the website and everything. You can actually go and follow the instructions. It's relatively simple to copy it and paste it down. And then you can zoom into it and see how they move. And you can also increase or decrease the generational life. And the person that wrote this recommends only drawing every 512 generations. Because if you don't do that, it operates too slowly. Right. Because, of course, you can imagine all these things move really slowly. What's amazing to me about this is that it is extremely simple pattern. And the other aspect comes to this, and I've talked a lot with Warren about this idea, is that what is the program and what is the data becomes really abstract. In some ways, the operating system is the rule set of the automaton life structure, if I have two neighbors, I'm alive. If I have three neighbors, I'm alive. If I have less or more, I die. That rule set is kind of the operating system. And the language, if you will, is the abstractions we build on top of that. Like, I am going to put, if I were to describe this, I might have some language around it. I would be able to put a glider. Right. So a glider is kind of like part of the programming language.
Right. The language itself are these basic shapes that you know create some effect.
Yeah, in some ways you have to think at that level, right? You have to think at a larger abstracted level. Additionally, when you're talking about how the program runs, the only input you actually put in is a bitmap image. Like, that's actually technically the input. And every generation is a bitmap image. But it's amazing to me to think that, like, here's a picture, which is actually a program, which is just a neat way of thinking. Of course, that's also data in some ways. So it's really, it's a complicated way of thinking about programming when you get to that level of indirection or abstraction.
At the same time, for me, being a visual person, this really connected with me because instantly when I took a look at the large shapes and just the way it was shooting off bits into one area, I got some intuitive sense of how these very simple rules could create something complex.
Yeah.
Speaking of complexity, I realized that I keep forgetting to do corrections and I really wanted to do them for the previous show.
Okay, well, let me talk a bit about Turing completeness, and then you can do some corrections after we finish this story. Turing completeness, a computational system that can compute every Turing computable function is called Turing complete. And then there's also, so it's all the functions of that. I'm not going to get into the details of that.
Which is like a recursive definition.
Yeah, in some ways it is. And then Turing equivalence has to do with whether two systems are equivalent in their Turing function completeness. And that's just a better way to describe it, because then you can say, well, this system can do all these things. This other system can also do all these things. And comparing them is actually easier than defining all the things they can do. But anyways, there's a great article about this if you want to do more research on it. And I also recommend that you go and take a look at Building a Digital Clock in Conway's Game of Life, which is up at geekspeak.org. And today's episode is March 15th. The Ides of March is when we'll release this episode. Of course, it is also episode, 8 or 9, episode 9, season 17. Thanks, Brian, for that. I had a lot of fun playing with this thing, too, when you pasted it in. And I shared it off with Warren, and he was amazed that somebody had spent the time to program that.
Oh, so he wasn't aware of something
he wasn't
built
aware,
like that?
Aware of this kind of complication. But he's, aware of gliders. We've talked a lot about how you actually do program in that environment. I just have never seen such a complicated program.
It reminds me, actually, in terms of taking something very mundane, as it were, and putting something special or nostalgic into it like that. Reminds me of people putting Doom onto the MacBook Pro's touch bar.
Yes, I saw that story. That's great.
Well, there's another element to this, because I just saw the movie Hidden Figures.
Yeah, great movie.
Yeah, about the women that were at NASA that helped do the calculations for the space launches. And, back then, everybody was called a computer if you did the computing.
Mm-hmm.
And so... my kids kept talking to me. I was like, why do they keep calling these people computers? But
for 200 years. Yeah.
And at the same time, what we think of a computer now is so graphical and so disconnected from math and calculations. And when you step back a moment and you think about first the people called computers, and then later that these machines were doing just math, as in trying to calculate different things needed for the space program or for shooting weapons Project or rockets. Yeah.
Sure.
And now what we have is created from the same things, and it does all of this graphical...
We have War of the Clans on a tablet.
I love going back to first elements and building back up again and realizing where all this comes from.
All right, corrections from previous episodes. Miles, go.
Yes, I was absolutely wrong about simple hash algorithm. It's secure hash algorithm.
It's not that simple.
They are not simple.
Alex corrected us on this.
Or rather, many of them tend to be fairly simple, not much code, but their goal is security. I should not have been referring to them as a signature. They are called hashes. Signatures have to do more with making sure that...
You were taking, if you took a large file and you made a hash of it, you were kind of calling that a signature as the output.
Right.
But the complication of that is that there's algorithms that produce things and you need signatures for those things. And public key, private key, and signing right. things. So you didn't want to...
So there's an actual reason why these things are called that in security spheres. And so it's better to use their terms.
And their term is secure hash?
Yeah, it's a secure hash.
Cool.
And I talked about SHA-3 and SHA-256, SHA-512. Actually, SHA-2 is the one that's in heavy use. SHA-3 is out there and uses a fundamentally different algorithm. It's one of the points of it that it uses something completely different. So if there is a failure in SHA-2, then they could migrate to SHA-3 and not be subject to those same limitations.
Oh, so part of it was actually making sure there was different functions.
But
very cool.
SHA-2 is actually held up quite well. And so it is the industry standard right now, not SHA-3.
Oh, okay.
So I got, a lot of things wrong. And thank you very much, Alex, our Southern California correspondent, for straightening me out on that.
Yeah, it's great. Anytime you have a correction for us, we'd love to have them. And we'll definitely try to add into the show to make sure everybody learns the correction. Anything else? He's good.
It's funny.
I don't think I got anything else wrong.
Never have. Right?
It's funny. While I was listening to that episode, I was yelling into my car radio, but explain why it's a signature. Which, of course, maybe that was a misused term. But,
yeah. We could definitely get into public key and private key and signatures, which is a totally different topic point. But yeah. It's interesting because I, after this, part of the correction or feedback we got was that, we spend time describing things that programmers understand pretty well. And then we also spend time not explaining anything about something. We just assume that mm-hmm. people know about it. And that has to do with kind of the mood I'm in and how much I want to dive into an idea and how much news stories are in front of us for the day and that kind of thing.
And lifelong geek syndrome, When you've known something for so long, you've forgotten what it's like not to know it.
Do you recall, though, earlier in this program, you know, 15, 20 years ago, whatever, you'd say USB, and I'd say, that's Universal Serial Bus. Like, that was an important thing to say, you know? Of course, we...
16 years ago, or 17 years ago, that
it was a new thing, of course, yeah. I was just dealing with it, trying to get some media off a DV tape, and so I borrowed somebody's, cassette record player.
Wait, yeah. Do you still have that?
The cassette, the DV tape recorder? Yeah. Yeah, I've got it in a bag. But I was trying to connect a FireWire DV port, which is the micro FireWire port, to my MacBook Pro, which has USB-C. And so I had a micro FireWire to FireWire 400 from a 400 cable to an 800 cable from an 800 to a Thunderbolt adapter from a Thunderbolt adapter to a USB-C.
And it worked?
No, not even close. But I pulled out my daughter's MacBook, which has an 800 port on it, FireWire 800 port. It's the only FireWire device I've got in the house. And even then, I couldn't get the micro to 400 to 800 to work. So it's either the cassette, the darn DV, you know, camcorder, which is 15 years old, or it's just you can't do that. But in any case, it's frustrating to think that, like, at one point I remember it was like, okay, I'm going to keep these DV tapes because they're digital and they won't degrade. And I'm, oh yeah, this would be awesome. I have no way to get them off, you know, from this house. I had to borrow somebody's machine. So, of course, I'm going to take it down to some house and have it.
So a DV tape, as opposed to a...
I mean, mini DV tapes, not DAT, with digital audio tapes. And it's funny because I got these tapes. They're supposedly of my grandmother who recently passed away. We're doing a memorial in the month. And so everybody's giving me audio and pictures and I'm kind of making a collection of stuff about my grandmother, Shirley. And so I was given this bag and someone's like, here's some audio tapes and there's also some VHS tapes. I'm like, I don't want to deal with VHS, but audio tapes, okay. So I'm like, oh, I don't have a DAT anymore. I used to have a DAT, but I'll get one. So I ask a friend, he loans me a DAT. So now, and he kind of gave it to me. So now I've got a DAT player, which is great because I've got old GeekSpeak episodes too, which would be fun to kind of pull off.
And put those are stuck on DVD?
I do have some, no, DAT.
On DAT? Okay, DAT. You do have DAT.
I do have DAT. So then I pull out these tapes of my grandmother and I go to take them to the DAT player and they're mini DV tapes. I'm like, oh, they're videotapes. But I get the playing them. They're amazing. This is somebody did this, this interview of my grandmother over 4 days. It was like 3 hours of her talking about her life and her teaching of art and it's really good quality video, and two of them have good quality audio, and it's amazing. It's like a little film. I can cut something together really nice if I can get the stuff off this DV tape, because I need to be able to do that.
We'll talk later. All right. I've got a machine just for that.
Woohoo! Where the heck were we?
We were on your story talking about Mars.
Oh, I was about to talk about Mars. Let's do that. After almost 6.5 years, Congress just passed a bill for authorizing money to go to NASA. Effectively, NASA gets a certain amount of money, and that money doesn't change until another bill gets addressed. And the bill increased the amount of money going to NASA by $300 million. So it went from $19.2 billion in 2016 to $19.5 billion now.
So the annual budget goes up by this much.
The annual budget goes up by $300 million. Now, along with that, the act reaffirms the support for America in space. I think the actual quote, well, I won't do the quote on it, but some other aspects of this, which is interesting, they include like a 146-page document with following sections. One of them is assuring core capabilities for exploration, which calls for missions to include unmanned launch of space launch systems and including manned moon missions in 2021. And it'll specifically a journey to Mars, a whole section, which seeks NASA roadmap for sending humans to Mars by 2033 and plans to pursue asteroid redirection missions and things of that nature. So a pretty big mandate with some more funding coming out of the current Congress. I don't think it's actually been signed yet by the president.
So, of course, it's been since George W. Bush's administration that the goal for reaching Mars was announced, right? And here we go. We're still working towards there. Of course, Everyone loves manned missions. Do we need to get into the whole debate between manned and unmanned missions?
I think we need to do manned missions. I mean, I get the idea that it's not as efficient and humans are really weak and stupid in space, but there's something core as an exploration that it makes a lot of sense for me for us to leave the planet. Miles, what do you think? Manned or non-manned?
I think that there are only some questions that can be answered by having a human being out there. And also when you have a drone, you have that lag time between when you see something to when you get the image back to wait, I need to tell the instruction, tell the drone to move over to the side to take another look at it, to then do another thing. Drones are good for long-term, a long-term mission. The Pathfinder, like, have been wonderful, Spirit and Opportunity. But if you also have a human being there, like when we send human beings to the moon, actual geologists to go and take samples and see things and know firsthand the person who's there, hey, this is interesting, as opposed to waiting for instructions. And it, and there's also that, as you were speaking of, that spirit of adventure, that that sense of the explorer, that's something that we don't have as much as we used to. It used to be hundreds of years ago, people jumped on a ship and went off into the unknown, as it were.
I got to say, I'm looking forward to us potentially grabbing some asteroid and orbiting the moon. I mean, these are cool things.
Yeah, I'm not looking forward to there being life lost, but at the same time, we do a lot of things that put human lives at risk that I feel are far less noble.
Yeah. What do you think, Brian?
Oh, I've always been persuaded by the idea that we can do just as much with probes without people in space, but you know, it's definitely inspiring to get people up there. So maybe if we did the probe drone sort of path, we would have autonomous cars sooner through the technology that'd be invented.
Nice.
Whereas if we did put people in space, we'll be able to, I don't know, survive inhospitable environments more easily.
Yeah. All right. Well, cool. Thanks for that update.
And speaking of Mars.
Yeah, speaking of Mars, you getting to the Mars thing?
Yes. One of the issues with going to Mars and sending human beings there is food.
Yes.
One of the great staples of food that we have are potatoes.
That's like the movie, man.
Do we have to go there?
And to that end, the International Potato Center, yes, there is
an
International Potato Center, has launched a series of experiments to see if you can grow potatoes on Mars. What they've done is they've taken...
Is this completely because of the recent movie?
This sounds like a marketing effort.
I don't know. Potatoes are conspicuously hardy.
Yeah.
They're, you know, you bury them, you wait, you grow. And one of the great things about potatoes is, just like it was portrayed in the movie, but you cut off part of a potato and you plant it again and you have another crop, as opposed to, you know, getting just seeds and trying to replant from seed is a whole
different
game.
More complicated life, more complicated reproductive structure.
There's a reason why potatoes are a popular crop.
Yeah.
And
so how are they assessing whether they're going to work in Mars atmosphere?
So they're trying to take the soil to be similar to what you would find on Mars, the salinity, the lack of moisture, things like that. Of course, you would have to add moisture to there. And they've put them into these containers that are lower in pressure, you know, to mimic Mars's pressure, lower the levels of oxygen, raise carbon dioxide levels, or at least relatively speaking.
Sure.
And
still a lighter atmosphere, but yeah.
Yes. Putting it onto a CubeSat with nutrient-rich water.
A CubeSat?
Yeah, a Cube satellite, small satellite.
Oh, they're actually putting it in low orbit?
Right. So, because you also want to have it not be in 1G.
Okay, that's cool.
And seeing how it works out. And it turns out that they actually have been surviving. They've been getting some good
results.
How
do they taste?
I don't know. But in addition to this research to make sure that they can have food grow on Mars, which is in and of itself really cool, what this does is it also shows avenues for having crops like potatoes grow in more extreme environments on the Earth, more arid environments, such as the Peruvian desert.
Right.
So, because if you can get something growing on Mars, there are a lot of places on Earth that are less hostile.
So, I mean, are they changing the potato to be able to do this?
I'm sure there's some breeding going on. I mean,
are they pulling out CRISPR and totally modifying it completely?
They're definitely not planting at the poles.
Yeah.
Those get cold.
Yeah.
But if you're near the equator, fun fact, Mars had a heat wave, and its highest recorded temperature was about 60 degrees Fahrenheit.
That's a comfortable day.
Yes,
that's
exactly.
Cool.
That's something you can deal with. Now, it's not always that.
Besides the lack of oxygen.
No, there's oxygen. Anyway. But there's always going to be colder days than that. I mean, that was the highest recorded temperature they've ever had. But that's still a lot easier to handle, and that's something that a tuber that has some heft to it, you know, the potatoes are fairly hardy. It can handle situations like that.
So
can handle a freeze.
So definitely, if we do manned space travel, there'll be want fries with that. That'll be a standard thing. That's cool. let's talk about Google's algorithms, shall we?
Oh yeah. So this was wandering around the net this past couple of weeks, which was both funny and scary at the same time. So have you ever typed into Google where it returns you a instant answer along with all of the search results?
They refer to as answer cards within Google.
Yes.
It says former Google engineer. you know, I don't think I've paid much attention to it actually giving back responses, except for mathematical questions.
I see Wikipedia answers in that box quite often as well, which is
sure,
helpful.
Sure, but you're talking about the search results happening after you hit enter, not like while you're typing. Not the autocomplete.
No, not in
boxes.
Yeah, not the instant. Not Google Instant, but the answer card.
Okay. So when I'm searching and I've just typed in like GeekSpeak and then it completes the phrase somehow, mm-hmm. that's called instant?
The drop-down is called instant, but the page does load. You'll notice as you're typing, the page will end up loading
if
there's any type of pause.
It's frustrating when you're trying to read something in the page you're in and type a search response of that, then it swaps it out. It's really frustrating. But anyways, go on. So that's called instant, the page loading behind or the drop-down?
The drop-down.
Okay, the drop-down is called...
The answer card is...
What comes below.
Yes.
So that's when you get like a Wikipedia entry as your answer to the question. Like,
right, you'll have an answer card or a media card. You know,
I got that when I was talking...
If you type in Madonna and it comes up with Madonna, that's a
card. When I searched Turing Complete, one of the cards was the Wikipedia entry about Turing completeness. Okay, so
you know, as I talk about this, I got to ask you now, because I can't recall, the... I feel lucky button is long gone, right?
No, I think I feel lucky.
No,
still
I think
there.
They still have that, especially because whenever they tried to get rid of it, people rebelled. No, I want this.
Well, I can't find it.
Oh, it's gone now?
Well, when you... Yeah, I don't see it.
Well, the importance of this answer card is this is Google's algorithm attempting to give you a direct answer to your search query. So as not to have to click through the multiple links and to get a quick answer. And this is taking on new meaning now that Google Home and Google Assistant are out, and where you really don't want to have a list of results. You want to have the Google Assistant speak back to you the most likely answer.
Right.
So... There's been some interesting things that happen out of that, though, because Google has to determine what is the correct answer to your question. And although sometimes it doesn't know, sometimes it gets it just flat out wrong. There's this author over at Gizmodo who is finding that his name is Tom Soka. He's found that an article that he specifically wrote to debunk the amount of time it takes to caramelize an onion... now when he types it into Google, he's getting the misconception returned to him as an answer.
How long does it actually take to caramelize an onion?
Well, in his research, as he said, if you try to cook an onion at the hottest possible temperature that you can do it at to caramelize it, you can do it in about 28 minutes. If you take a more pragmatic approach where you do a little bit lower temperature, you can do it in about 45 minutes. So he was on a mission several years ago to make this clear because he kept finding the wrong information. Well, now when you ask and type into Google, how long does it take to caramelize onions, you will get his initial statement in his article that he was trying to debunk, which is about 5 to 10 minutes.
Oh, I see. Because he became authoritative. Yeah, it says about 5 minutes. he became authoritative as an answer, but in his text, it's being parsed wrong. In the beginning,
course.
It says, you know, people say that it takes about 5 minutes. Really, that's not the answer, but because his page is the answer, it became the answer.
Right. So Google's AI to pull out the data, pull out the succinct answer from this particular link, gets it wrong. But this one's funny. This one's cute. But it can go really wrong. There's also an example of if you ask Google specifically.
So what I have right here is from the authoritative answer about, I wrote, how long does it take to caramelize an onion? And by the way, Miles, though Google.com, when you go to Google.com, it says I feel lucky. As you start typing, the typed results move to the top, and then the button goes away. You can't actually ever click that button, which is really weird. Anyway.
So I'm sorry, when it goes wrong, a good example of that is if you type in, is Obama planning a coup? And you get a fake news story about how Obama may have been planning a coup d'etat towards the end of his presidency. And it cites quite a few items within that, making it sound like a very authoritative answer.
Right. So it says about 5 minutes, and the onions, add the onions to the skillet and increase the heat to medium high. Cook until they begin to turn dark brown and somewhat soft, about 5 minutes, and it goes on. But the title of the webpage that this is coming from is Why Do Recipe Writers Lie About How Long It Takes to Caramelize Onions? It's a Slate article, which I'm assuming is his article.
It is.
So it's really interesting that like the content was pulled out of context from the page and parsed and used as the answer. That's wrong. The article itself has the correct information in it. Really interesting. The fake news thing, though, about the coup d'etat of Obama, that's just a multiple stories, the same content being written all over the place and producing
facts. And linked to one another.
And linked to one another. Which, of course, is kind of the problem we have right now with what is truthy and what is not truthy on the internet. That the algorithms are defined the truthiness by the amount of links that occur to it.
Well, it's not as simple as that, but yes, that is the basis of Google's algorithm.
And in fact, more than that, it's not transparent to us how it works. And the reason is they're trying not to be taken advantage of.
Right.
So the algorithms get complicated.
So we can't have nice things on the internet because everyone tries to game it and making Google's job all that harder, making it harder for us to get what we want just by speaking to the assistant.
By the way, the coup story of Obama, now the primary article is about Google search results being pushed.
That's right. That generally happens whenever there is an embarrassing story that pops up to the top of the search results.
It becomes the
topic. It becomes the story, and then becomes,
very self-referring. Frustrating. Okay, interesting. Thanks. Hey, what's up with Firefox, Miles?
Firefox version 52. That's right. You heard that right.
That's
version
a lot.
52.
Like a deck of cards.
So what do we do when we get 100 to 100? Do we just stop using the numbers?
Mm. That'll be the last version of Firefox for Windows XP and Windows Vista.
They're still making it for XP?
Still making them.
Wow.
Because cool. You absolutely shouldn't be using them, but you absolutely, positively should not be using those with Internet Explorer.
Right. If you're on XP, use Firefox.
Well, stop using XP, but that's a whole other conversation that I need to have with my aunt. So,
just buy her a Mac, dude. Buy her Chromebook.
The thing is, Firefox 52 is a long-term release, which means they're going to be doing bug fixes for it for some time. So this will be the last version, so new features won't be coming out for that, but there will be security patches being applied to it. And this is the same way that Google Chrome has been handled as well. And not the way that Internet Explorer has been handled. Please, if you're on XP or Vista, if you can't get off of them, please just stop using Internet Explorer. It hurts you.
It hurts us.
Now, that said,
Why is your aunt still using XP?
Because computers cost money. That and I haven't spent the time to go down to visit her to set up the Chromebook. For her.
So you are planning to move to Chromebook. Because I think that's the solution. Of course, an old Windows machine, you can't exactly put Chrome OS on it.
Well, it's an old tower, and it was long in the tooth anyway, so got her a Chromebook laptop.
Sure.
So it's just a matter of finding the time to drive 3 hours to go help it out, help set it up.
Be like Miles. Give people Chromebooks. Get them off XP.
Well, be unlike Miles and actually show up to tech support and get it up and running before you leave.
Anything else interesting about 52?
Yes, indeed. It's the first browser to support WebAssembly.
Okay, so WebAssembly is exciting to me, but I can't even say that I fully understand it yet.
Okay. So
this isn't ASM.js?
No, it's the next iteration of that. ASM.js was the first attempt to make it so that you could compile, for example, C or C++ or the like to JavaScript as a target, but in a very limited syntax set, mostly
strict
numeric.
JavaScript, yeah. If you will.
You're not interacting with the DOM. You're not interacting with a lot of the general libraries, but it was really good for numeric processing, number crunching, things that took a lot of processing power, and JavaScript just ended up being a bottleneck.
Right. This is how we saw Doom in a browser, right? Or was that Quake?
It was actually Unreal.
Yeah,
it was the Unreal engine in the browser.
Yeah, Brandon Eich likes to present that at shows.
Yeah.
Right. Much better than Doom. Doom was easy. That's a solved problem.
It's really an amazing situation when you start seeing that. But basically, ASM stands for Assembly.js, basically. The idea is that you're kind of compiling to a pseudo-assembly language that's actually run in JavaScript before.
Right. It's not a... it's not something that you would want to write as a human being.
Right.
It's not meant to be a dialect that you're writing yourself by hand. It is something that you would put into something called Inscripten and then compile your language and that have that be a target, just like you would have an Intel processor be a target or an ARM processor, you would have JavaScript be a target.
But if you looked at the compiled code, you would see JavaScript syntax in a very unreadable form.
Yes, that's exactly what you would see.
You'd be able to understand it and parse it and grok it, but it wouldn't be.
But it's
you couldn't write.
Doing array lookups and things like that to get around the fact that it isn't intended to be garbage collected. It's meant to be for programs that are doing malloc and free or malloc and delete and.
So it's not how you'd write JavaScript. Anyway, go on. So what's WebAssembly then?
So WebAssembly is the next iteration where they're trying to find a binary syntax for it to reduce the size of the JavaScript payload that goes over. So it's no longer JavaScript.
Oh, because, of course, you're kind of creating a subset, putting it in JavaScript, and you have to kind of make it explode it out. Like every time you define a function, you have to have the word function in it.
Right.
Things like that.
But if you make a very strict bytecode, it's much easier to verify the syntax is correct. You don't have to do a lot of the tricks like putting in 5 pipe 0, which specifies this is an integer value, not a floating point value.
Right. So that's part of the things that's a little strange is that you're using an OR character to define a type because that's a side effect of JavaScript.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So WebAssembly basically is saying let's standardize around a way of denoting a more efficient assembly of the web, if you will, like a base core you could run on a JavaScript engine.
Yes.
And that's WebAssembly.
Right.
Specified by the W3C? I would assume.
I don't know that they're on board. I think this is mostly led by industry. So Firefox, Chrome, the Edge team is on board for this. So Microsoft as well, Safari.
They're putting this in Firefox 52, which does run on XP.
I don't know actually that it might be disabled.
Oh, okay.
For that. Because it is such a new feature. Normally with browsers like Chrome and Firefox nowadays are referred to as evergreen browsers. Every week or two you get a hey, update your browser and you restart your browser and it has a whole new version, and unless you hold off on that, in which case your Chrome has a nice bright red thing in the top right-hand corner saying you really haven't, you need to restart your browser now. So because you're not having any more versions of Firefox 52, I think they have disabled that by default.
Got it. That makes sense. Well, cool. WebAssembly is out, and we'll see more progress on it.
So what do you expect to have happen with this? Is this an initiative to get more performant web apps out there, or is this a way to allow people to use other languages to write for the web?
Yes. now, for getting things more performant, yes. When you're doing things that have to do with numerics, a lot of heavy number crunching, JavaScript is usually not the language you want to do it in. You want to have something that is a bit more efficient than that. And you want to combine that with the web, meaning that you're able to transmit that client to many different places, but having the whole separate install step. And you also want to have some modicum of security. The code that comes down is still subject to the same browser restrictions that JavaScript would be.
Can I ask something? Like, one of the things I can't do on a Chromebook is edit audio. Of course, because of GeekSpeak, I edit a lot of audio, and I use Adobe's Audition. Couldn't Adobe theoretically compile a version of Audition for WebAssembly, and then I could run Audition in my browser?
That is simplifying, because WebAssembly is not meant to interact with the graphical user interface. You're not building GUIs.
But you can take advantage of OpenGL.
You can take advantage of OpenGL. You can, you can run the, generate the shader code. You can do some of that stuff. But you're still having to pull that out after you've processed it to then shunt it to the WebGL engine or the canvas.
We saw a full 3D game running at full speed.
Mm-hmm. For games, it's great because you were able to do that number crunching and sometimes do that number crunching off the main thread and then come back and then...
Because you can run that, you theoretically could run any kind of UI. I mean, but of course, there's no tool set there for you.
The point being that WebAssembly cannot call DOM methods.
Well, I wasn't talking about DOM.
It can't call the canvas.
You don't need canvas. You don't need any of that, right? I mean, I have seen...
For audio. You're talking about for audio.
Well, I'm just talking about even in UI in general. Unreal is a really amazing UI, right? It just doesn't have all the widgets you're normally used to, but if you're rendering it all yourself and generating it yourself...
What I mean is that WebGL canvas that you see is separate from the WebAssembly. WebAssembly cannot directly call that WebGL canvas.
Oh, not even WebGL. Oh, okay.
You need to have glue code that calls out to the WebAssembly, says, process this information, give it back to me, and then that JavaScript glue code then goes back and says, okay, now paint this to WebGL.
Do you see a future space where all binaries are in WebAssembly?
I don't for the near future. Anything is possible, and I honestly hope not, because binary blobs are opaque to introspection, to people looking at and seeing what's going on with it. You could have some of it has been lost already just by virtue of the fact that you have minifiers for JavaScript, so you've lost your variable names and the like, but it's still an extra step away from it. One of the things that I am sad about in terms of loss is on the web, how you and I, Lyle, and to some extent, I'm sure Brian as well, you're old enough, learned how to do web pages by seeing a page you like, you go to view source, and you see what happened. And nowadays, the tooling has become better. You can do some of that over using the web inspector, but it really has become so complex, it has become largely inscrutable to beginners.
The Netflix.com website is running React as the web UI.
Speaking of inscrutable.
And it is it is not easy to figure out what's going on. I mean, isn't a developer, you've got to do develop tools and everything. The compiled app, the running compiled app, is a very different beast than what you write. At the same time, there's extensions and stuff to make React development easier. But I know what you mean. We talked about porn earlier and being, it used to be a source as a web developer on how do you do video streaming? Right, and this is like real video streaming. How is it being done? Oh, this is a compressive JPEG. That's what's actually being delivered. That's how they're doing video. That's pretty neat. In general, just being able to figure out how to open Windows and things. You'd go to a website that could do it, and you'd simply do a view source and go, oh, that's how you do it. Copy that code and modify it.
I do worry that this horse is now out of the barn. We now live in a time where it's harder to get those first steps and know an easy way to start. Now,
so so the web is no longer the place for somebody to just pick up and start hacking and learn programming on their own.
Well, on the bright side, tutorials are in much greater supply than they were when we started.
And don't forget YouTube videos teaching you how to do things.
And the other options of all these languages that have come out recently that are based on making a safer language that can help you learn in that way as well.
Mm-hmm. Swift and using Rust JS Fiddle or something like that, which is extremely helpful for writing something out and sharing with somebody and demoing it. There's some really great features that exist now too.
Now, will it show show the door to JavaScript? I don't believe that will be the case. JavaScript is an easy enough language to learn, and it is so ubiquitous. I don't think that it's going away. People have talked about how they'd prefer to have Python to JavaScript, for example. But having that Python transpiling step to go to WebAssembly, let alone to try to convert it to JavaScript, just I don't see it as being a really viable, really something that in the large, like people are going to migrate to en masse.
Yeah.
I see it more as when you have something that needs to be performance critical, that something that you have found a problem and you need to speed things up, then you're going to fall back to a language like C, C++, Rust, or Go, and then transpile that to WebAssembly just to get that extra code because you're already going to be comfortable with a binary format.
So have you seen a grander vision where they want to take it to the point where you can interact directly with the DOM or make it so that you can write completely in another language and transpile over?
There are plans for that. The question is whether or not it will get that same traction.
The DOM, by the way, is the document object model. It's the way you interact with HTML from JavaScript.
Right. Which, and it's also a fairly horrible API. So I don't
know. I've grown to like it. Just because I know it's well.
Stockholm syndrome.
It is.
I'm well versed in it as well. I know it intimately well. At the same time, it's not a very well done or elegant API. It's the reason why libraries like Prototype and jQuery came about, just to smooth it over and make it usable.
All right, let's move on to one more story in the normal show, and that is daylight saving time, baby. What is your problem with it?
Okay, so Twitter's become my friend over the last year. And sure. I've got to say, nothing exploded as much as when we had our presidential election. But right behind that is the complaints I've seen related to daylight savings time.
Why? What's the complaint? What's the problem?
Everybody seems to think it's absolutely worthless. It just gets in our way and it makes us tired and accidents. And I don't know what.
What do you mean accidents?
Well, I heard a statistic that there is something like a 25% increase in accidents the day after Monday after daylight saving time.
Because people aren't used to the flow.
Because people are tired.
I do know the traffic today was unusually heavy.
That might be biased.
It's like giving an entire region an hour of jet lag. It's exactly what you're doing.
Yeah. Do you really get jet lag from an hour? I mean, hour of difference is what? I mean, is it because people don't wake up as easily and therefore
right,
their morning routine? I mean, it's true. This morning, I skipped coffee until I was, you know, halfway
we're not,
to work.
But we're not talking about coast-to-coast jet lag. We're talking about a little bit. That little bit that is the difference between a near miss in the car accident and you actually hit.
Yeah.
That difference in stress between whether or not you just don't feel well and you know, have a cup of coffee and move on, or you have a stroke.
Well, why don't we get rid of it?
Well, I've even heard ideas of getting rid of time zones.
Or at least most of them, yeah.
Well, just using a Earth time.
I haven't heard that far. I've seen proposals for switching the U.S. to two time zones.
Instead of four?
Yeah.
Do we have four or do we have five?
Within mainland, we have four. Hawaii is its own time zone.
Huh.
But yeah, car accidents, strokes, heart attacks, they all spike around March. That and one of the issues behind it was saying, hey, we're going to save some save electricity.
Okay, I remember hearing this lots and lots of times. So what's the problem with that one?
Well, it was hard to find a counterfactual. Like, how do you know that it's going to be the case? Well, Indiana, the state of Indiana, until recently did not have daylight savings time. But they did implement it in 2006.
Why?
Probably peer pressure.
Was this the whole state? I thought it was partial state did have it and partial did not.
Well, Indiana is a partition state. It's really odd. Half the state is in one time zone, half the state is in another.
It
makes it
why.
Also a unique case. But they ended up using more electricity than before they had implemented daylight saving.
Interesting. So you have a case study.
Yeah, and cool. It's only been around since, 1970s energy crisis, but it turns out that it doesn't really even save energy.
So it's just dumb and dangerous and costs more money.
And just makes my kids complain.
Why are they complaining?
Because they had to get up this morning.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence's user permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, so use our stuff. Anyway, we'd like just to let them know that we said hello, that we made it. Today's episode is by Greg Merkley. He has given the title of Martian Spuds Neutral on Daylight Savings Time. Thanks to Michael Newman of Pet Star Music for our theme song. And thank you, Miles Elam and Brian Young, for joining me in my noisy kitchen with the background of my dog Higgs Boson.
Always a pleasure.
Yay, it was fun.
Post-show news, Miles, I know you actually have some stories.
Wait, before we get into that, yeah. I have to do an addendum to my story about Google, because I just realized I forgot to say an important point. So I've got this Google Home at home now that my kids love to play all the games that are available on it, like there's a game show game. They love to play the Magic 8-Ball game. No, I'm sorry, it's the Crystal Ball game. But this is the kind of thing where you ask the Crystal Ball some question and it gives you a mysterious answer. But this is Google, so they can't just leave it at that. They have to make sure that they repeat multiple times that this is just a game and this is not actually reality. And
every time that you ask
every time you ask it.
How irritating.
Irritating for me. My kids don't seem to notice it. But I do appreciate the fact that they don't want this kind of false idea of how you get knowledge getting out there.
I think that's kind of cool. What kind of questions and answers? What kind of questions is it?
Oh, you could ask, am I going to fall in love today?
And okay, hang on. Hey, Alexa, am I going to fall in love today?
I can't find the answer to the question I heard.
So it does, Crystal Ball does better than that?
Oh, yeah. It'll give you some funny answer.
Okay. I find the digital assistances, besides playing, completely useless. Like, I don't get anything out of her. I mean, I find my phone is kind of nice.
The kitchen timers. That's the
kitchen timer.
Yeah,
totally. The kitchen timer is great.
It's a very expensive kitchen timer.
Hey, Alexa, set a timer for 5 minutes.
5 minutes, starting now.
I mean, that is cool, I have to say.
Have you tried doing the that audio drop so that anybody listening to the recording can't trigger their Alexa?
No, I haven't done that. It's the 5 kilohertz slice.
Yeah.
If I get to it, I'll do it on this episode.
See if I get to it.
what are the things that I like about her? I think that's pretty much it, the timers.
About her, not it. I like that.
It's an it, definitely. Well, I wanted to separate from Google Home. I have no experience with Google Home. Oh, okay, another thing. Alexa, set the profile to Lyle. Alexa, find my phone.
To use the tracker skill, you can say, ask tracker to find my phone. Or if you have not enabled this skill, please visit the Alexa app and search for tracker.
Alexa, ask tracker to find my phone.
To enable the tracker skill, go to the skill.
I'm pretty sure I already enabled it. It's annoying. Say,
Alexa seems perfect for government. The bureaucracy is just...
it's just tiring. By the time I'm done, I'm like, yeah, that's neat. I'd rather program something. CIA? WikiLeaks?
Yeah, this one would be short. WikiLeaks did a dump of a lot of captured CIA documents.
Yeah, a lot of laughing about CIA in the papers, basically.
Yeah, and, well, not a lot of news in general. It hasn't been getting much play. But one thing that I think is noteworthy is that encryption works. The CIA is getting stymied by encryption, so...
Well, no, what I'm saying about the stories in the news was the first story is that all Samsung televisions are listening to you in your home, right?
Yes.
Well, no, the truth is that they investigated the possibility of doing that and maybe came to a conclusion of being able to do it.
And if they did do it, it took physical access to trigger it.
Yes. So it's like all these stories were hyperbola, mostly, and what you're saying is the real truth of it is encryption works.
Yes.
That's what we found out from WikiLeaks.
Yes.
I mean, of course, it's an embarrassing thing for the CIA to have private data being released again. And it's not even
again,
job. Well, Snowden did it, too.
Well, that was the NSA.
Yes, true.
The important distinction there is the NSA has a dual mission to provide information to our government as well as to protect these citizens. I don't believe the CIA has that protect aspect to their mission at all.
Yes, but the CIA has a prohibition of acting on U.S. soil.
Right? Yes. Or on U.S. citizens.
This next story, Miles, actually, I heard about too and found it amazing. The new Pi. Raspberry Pi.
Raspberry Pi 0W.
Which means Wi-Fi?
Which means wireless, yeah.
Yeah.
the original Pi Zero, $5, released in 2015, and it just kept getting sold out whenever it went into stock, which was funny because you could find it being sold for $20 a pop for what's supposed to be a $5 device. And the reason why you paid $5 was because it was really scaled down in terms of hardware processing power and the like and memory. And so you're paying $20 or $30, and you might as well get a full Pi.
Right. The full Pi is $30. The cheap one's $20 because people bought up the $5 stock and resold it.
Right. But they are very low power, and that's good.
They have Wi-Fi built in.
Well, now they have Wi-Fi built in. Before, they didn't.
I got to say, that is a big deal now because, you know, normally when you're doing small type of, you know, you want a dedicated computer to do something kind of fun, having to actually have it attached to a Ethernet cable is kind of a pain because you don't have Ethernet cables everywhere. So having these and be $5 and Wi-Fi...
Well, it's not $5 anymore. Apparently, Wi-Fi N and Bluetooth cost $5.
So it's $10 now?
So it's $10.
Oh, unacceptable. I wish I had the time and energy to do fun little side projects.
So you can run a Linux...
You are doing a side project, Lyle.
No, this isn't a side project. There's 17 years of doing something every week is not a side project. That's an insanity.
It's a non-lucrative career.
It's a non-lucrative career. Oh, man. We should talk about Inside Baseball a little bit. I've been having a lot of trouble with GeekSpeak lately.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. So, wait, Pi Zero anymore about this?
No. I'm not going to buy it. I already have two Pi 3s. I don't need another Pi device.
So, you know, we've been having wonderful people donate for our show. And, you know, our Patreon site, you can learn more about it. Go to geekspeak.org/support, and you can contribute. And, like, right now, we're pulling in $130 a month on GeekSpeak. So I did my taxes this year.
Uh-oh.
And, of course, now, all of a sudden, there's income. Like, you know, 16 years of doing GeekSpeak and never money to me. You know, money. There's the five-minute timer. Alexa, stop. So, you know, for years, any money that came in just went to the radio station. But the radio station has been gone, and now I'm spending $40 or $60 a month on hosting charges, depending on what's going on, and also on equipment. And so getting some support from our listeners has been really wonderful. And, of course, doing the tax, I'm like, okay, now it's time to, like, look at the taxes and all that. Not a big deal, but it's focusing on money. And because money's been coming in, and I haven't been doing, like, marketing campaigns, which is really what our intent was with any of the extra income, is to spread the show. I went ahead and was like, well, I got to, all of a sudden I'm looking at money coming in and money going out. I'm like, I got to spend some of this money on marketing. So I went ahead and spun up a Facebook ad. And last episode show, I did a full video of it. I uploaded to YouTube and I uploaded to Facebook and put multiple images throughout the show. So we talked for quite a while on the show. And as we talked about different topic points, I put in images. And I even added in a video. You mentioned a Ghost in the Shell, Miles, last episode, and you talked about the hands that split apart. Mm-hmm. So I found the footage of that and grabbed it and put it in the YouTube video and Facebook video. And then I ran ads on it. And, you know, we're not talking about a lot of money, but we're also not talking about it changing anything about our stats, except for our homepage got more hits, right? Because that's what we're actually effectively doing. But it doesn't change our subscription numbers.
So you mean those thousands of likes are not translating into anything?
No. Not translating into anything at all. So, like, looking at the stats on that, what I've kind of concluded was I'm bad at marketing, which, no kidding. Someone said, oh, yeah, did you say that?
Miles? No, I think it was Dee Dee that brought up that.
Dee Dee was like, yeah, lots of smart people spend their life doing marketing.
Yeah, that's people who go to school another for profession. This. Yeah.
Yes. And I think it's so funny. It's like, well, I've been involved in the internet for a long time. I have a good Twitter handle. No, that does not make a good marketing person. In any case, so it's a little frustrating to spend a lot of time actually editing together a video because I realized that running video ads and getting YouTube views potentially would bring an audience that way. It made sense. But the truth is, our show as a video is not a very good show, even with a few clips.
I'm here to try to help that by always talking about something visual.
It's just in this situation where I'm feeling like, well, we're not growing the audience. I don't know how to do that exactly. And that's just a kind of discouraging experience. And because I spent so much time editing the last episode's video, I didn't get an episode out last week, right? So we missed a week. First time.
Well, was the reason?
Well, I also couldn't talk, yeah. It's part of it, right? It's part of that extra amount of time. I'm also doing a second podcast at work. So that takes some audio editing time as well.
Which, you know, is an asset for your company, but you're not getting your time allocated for that, you're actually adding more time.
Yeah, I got just more work to do. It's true. It's cool, though. I get to talk well to really
done,
fun sir. People.
Well done.
But it's, you know, it's neat talking to really smart people. I love, I mean, the reason why we do Geekspeak is we love doing this, right? Mm-hmm. So this is just like that, except for internal private Netflix conversations, which is great if you work at Netflix. In any case, I'm not going to stop doing what we're doing. The amount of money I've spent in the last 2 years on Geekspeak versus the amount of income that we've taken in, I spent a lot more on Geekspeak than we're taking in. So it's not like I'm obligated to do more. So when Marco Arment released, he produces this podcast that we both listen to, mm-hmm. And two podcasts, actually. And also he has this wonderful iOS podcast player. If you're on iOS, I highly recommend you use Overcast. His site is Overcast.fm. And in this last couple weeks, he went ahead and said, hey, you can start buying ads. Now, ads on a podcast app is perfect because with one button, you can subscribe to the podcast. So I went and bought what I could get, which was the educational realm, because we're kind of educational, and that was available. And 4 days after it launched, he reimbursed me the funds because it's not getting the kind of traction. We've got 30 listeners, I think, or something like that. So it's not
30 new listeners.
30 new listeners from that. So welcome to Geekspeak. If you have listened to because of that ad on Overcast, thanks so much for doing that. Let us know. You can contact us at geeks@geekspeak.org. If you're still listening, that'd be kind of cool to know that.
This is where you drop again that you've been doing this for 17 years.
Yes. So anyway, I don't know what to do going forward. If we do have listeners that are marketing people and like to help out with that, that'd be great. I guess that'd be the best thing to do is get somebody in a professional realm helping out with that.
Yeah, and if you don't realize it, there's several people behind the scenes that are helping out in multiple ways. Greg, obviously you get called out quite often, but we've got all these other people, geeks that have been on the show before that contribute every once in a while as well. Mm-hmm.
It's true. It's a large group of people.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't go as far as say large. It's
well, it's
a group.
It's me running the server, building everything, editing all the shows, pulling people together, hosting all the equipment and the space.
Hey, I give you and a pull then request that didn't work.
That's true. Miles, you did spend a late night on me getting Nginx down and up and down and up. But no, I do appreciate you looking into that, even though it didn't work. definitely Greg has been this wonderful asset to our show for years now. He's helps in the background all the time. Thanks so much for doing that. I appreciate it, Greg. That's why I thank him every week. All right. Anything else we want to talk about before we close up the show?
Oh, I had to deal with some family tech support recently. My mom had one of these things where she was...
Was she running Windows XP?
No, she's on a Mac. It's an old Mac. I don't think... what is it? She's running probably 10.8 is the most recent OS she can be running. She said, I got this message. I didn't get to talk to her right away, but she got this message about how her computer is telling her that she needs to call tech support because she has a virus.
She said, no, Mom, don't do it.
A half an hour later is when I get the message. I call her back saying, Mom, first thing I say, have you talked to them? I'm on the phone right now. Have you given them your credit card? No, I haven't. Hang up right now. So I went through that whole experience, and that was fun. And, of course, this is just a little bit of JavaScript that prevented her from closing her browser that made her call. There was this tweet by John Gruber of Daring by Fireball fame. I got a kick out of this. He received in his spam box. Actually, it went into his main box. The spam box missed it. Dear account owner, your mailbox has exceeded the set storage limit of 20 gigabytes. You are currently running on 19.8 gigabytes due to hidden files and folders on your mailbox. Please, you are to fill in the below questions to validate your mailbox. Email address, first name, user ID, password, confirm password. Failure to follow this process will invalidate and cancel your quota.
Oh, man. It sounds very deviously good.
Yeah, so we've talked about phishing plenty of times, but... Goodness gracious.
You know, if you're listening to this program, you don't have to worry about this problem. But you do have to help your family and friends with this problem.
How do you educate people on this?
I don't know.
You get them to buy a Chromebook.
Yeah, you buy it.
No, that wouldn't help you one bit here.
Oh, right. The credit card number goes through. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, does Google check its outgoing email for your password and delete it? I guess not.
Mask your password?
I don't know. All right. Thanks, guys.
Always a pleasure.
I already said that.
It's good to be here.